The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the September 24th, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker. The Case for Having Lots of Kids. In Hannah's Children, an economist and mother of eight interviews highly educated women with large families and examines the reasons for America's declining fertility rate, by Emma Green. 3 years ago, J.D. Vance, who is now the Republican vice presidential nominee, said in a Fox News interview that America is being run by a, quote, bunch of childless cat ladies, end quote. This comment resurfaced over the summer, and celebrities such as Taylor Swift and Aubrey Plaza have recently declared both their love of cats and their intention to vote for Kamala Harris in the upcoming presidential election. But the cat lady memes have masked something deeper. Women in the United States are having fewer children, just as women in other industrialized countries are. It's a phenomenon that some refer to as the birth dearth. As of 2023, the average American woman will have 1.6 kids in her lifetime, and the number has been mostly declining for the past decade. The problems with this range from the short term to the existential. Social Security and Medicare are on track to become insolvent, even as boomers shake their coffers. Schools and universities can't fill their classes. Our society is a pyramid scheme, with the young supporting the old, and the bottom of the pyramid is eroding. One group that has defied America's declining fertility rate are the women who have five or more kids. Since 1990, around 5% of women aged 40 to 44 have been part of this category. Catherine Pakaluk, an economist at the Catholic University of America, recently set out to explain why. Pakaluk, who is in her late 40s, is herself the mother of eight children and the stepmother of six. In the summer of 2019, she and a colleague interviewed 55 women across the country, all of whom have between 5 and 15 children. Some of their interview subjects were well past their childbearing years. Others were in their 30s, perhaps with even more children to come. This past spring, a book about Pakaluk's findings, titled Hannah's Children, was released by Regnery, a publishing house known for its rightward bent. Although you won't find the book on a national bestseller list, it has become something of a cult classic among conservative wonks and policymakers. Arguments about fertility rates are often made in abstract economic terms, and for good reason. The abstraction is necessary to gloss over the topic's natural awkwardness in a society where a woman's reproductive future is generally considered a matter of personal freedom. To say that any one person or family should have kids or more of them is to violate a cultural taboo. But Pakaluk goes for it, making the case that having kids is good, not just for individuals, but for society. She argues that the true damage of the birth dearth is not economic disaster, but a distortion of our culture and politics. She and many of her subjects see a country hobbled by relentless individualism, people turning inward, pursuing their own happiness and success instead of investing in others. Maybe what ails us is not our freedom per se, but something we mistake for freedom, being detached from family obligations, which are actually the demands that save us from egoism and despair, she writes. This is the case not just for adults, but for children as well. Pakaluk points out that kids who grow up with lots of siblings learn to share space, time, and stuff. They must tolerate people who are different in opinion and personality. The family works against individualism by asserting a communitarian reality, Pakaluk writes. Pakaluk and her subjects are double outliers. She focused on women who not only have more kids than most Americans, but who also graduated from college. A number of her subjects have advanced degrees. Pakaluk herself has a PhD from Harvard. She picked these women because she wanted to understand the trade-offs between work and family. Becoming a mother to many children wasn't something they defaulted to, but something they deliberately chose. It's an unusual choice. According to a 2021 Center for Disease Control report, the average college-educated woman has roughly one fewer kid than the average high school dropout. Notably, all of the women interviewed are religious, mostly a mix of evangelicals, Mormons, Catholics, and Jews. The title of the book refers to the biblical Hannah, a barren woman who begged God for children and eventually bore six. A significant number of Pakaluk's subjects went through a journey of conversion. Whether they reached for a more observant life or rejected their own lonely single-child upbringings, they are self-consciously countercultural. They disliked the standard paths offered to educated women and went after something radically different. Perhaps because these women have already made choices that defy the norms of their class, they are able to state plainly the things that don't work about the way our culture expects families to raise kids. For example, many of them assert that an egalitarian split in parenting duties between moms and dads is often impossible, especially in the early days of a baby's life. We had this idea like it was going to be 50-50, one mother of five with a PhD says. We had to figure out how to let go of all that and how to embrace things that seemed stereotypically gendered, she added. The women are also clear-eyed about the fact that pursuing advanced degrees and successful careers makes it harder to have a family. College, medical school, law school, and the like don't require lower fertility. They just eat up childbearing years, Pakaluk writes. The biological deck is stacked against you. Even those who are able to juggle the demands of schooling, career, and family may eventually hit the limit of their ability to parent how they want. Pakaluk interviews one mother who had four of her five children, including twins, while pursuing tenure. The mother wistfully described waiting until her mid-40s to have her fifth baby because she was so stressed out by her job. Children need their mothers, she says. I don't think they need a giant institutionalized daycare system. I don't think they need preschool. I think they need their mothers. That's it. Like that mother, many of the women interviewed kept working after having kids. One is a part-time pediatrician. Another manages the schedule for a cleaning company while her music career is on hold. But even for the women with careers, having many children offered them tacit permission to let go of certain notions of success. It's wonderfully freeing, says one mother, a former corporate lawyer with six kids. It's the opposite of what the culture would tell you, I think, which is that this is a cage. For these women, giving up their individual freedom by having kids led them to a deeper sense of purpose and joy. As Pakaluk writes, my subjects describe their choice to have many children as a deliberate rejection of an autonomous, customized, self-regarding lifestyle in favor of a way of life intentionally limited by the demands of motherhood. Some readers might find Puckalook and her subjects overly judgmental toward other women. Puckalook explains that this isn't her intention. My full and real view is that women with much smaller families or no children at all may share the purposes, values, and virtues of the women I interviewed, even though life did not hand them the same opportunities, she writes. She points to the body of academic literature showing a fertility gap alongside the birth dearth. Women in developed countries have, on average, fewer children than they'd like, suggesting that the size of their families may not be a direct translation of their values. This is a group that the cat lady discourse seems to miss. Women who don't have the families they dream of, whether because of infertility or financial struggles or because they haven't found the right partner. And yet, some judgment is unavoidable. The fact is that a growing number of Americans don't want kids. And most of them don't want a minivan full, even if it were affordable and tenable. Most Americans do not want to live the way Puckalook and her subjects do. Puckalook clearly thinks that, as a culture, it is good to encourage young women to have families. The problem is how. She is skeptical of the kinds of family policies that progressives and pro-family conservatives advocate, such as increases to the child tax credit or baby bonuses from the government. To Puckalook, these proposals ignore the fundamental reasons that people have kids, and they also downplay the trade-offs involved. These programs take childbearing decisions to be a function of cash flow, of balancing the household budget. But that is, strictly speaking, false, she writes. A couple must consider the entire bundle of the costs of having a child, and that bundle includes what else a woman might wish to do with her time, talents, and money. Having kids is not just a matter of having less money to spend. It also involves categorical shifts in lifestyle, career prospects, and one's sense of self. Such programs may boost morale for families, Puckalook writes. They may boost the popularity of politicians, but they will not boost the birth rate. Her suggestion? Religion. Make it easier for churches and religious communities to run schools, succor families, and aid the needs of human life, she writes. Her subjects describe their trust in God as one of their primary motivations for having a kid, and then another and another. People will lay down their comforts, dreams, and selves for God, not for subsidies, Puckalook argues. To this end, she favors ending government restrictions on religious groups, particularly when it comes to education. If the state can't save the American family, she writes, it can give religion a freer rein to try. Her proposal, make more babies by making Americans more religious, is likely to persuade the highly educated women she seems to be writing for, and certainly won't appeal to the defiant cat lady set. This is an ambiguity in Puckalook's project. Is her goal to solve an intractable global problem, or simply to persuade more people to follow her path? Either way, Puckalook might have trouble achieving her ends. The worldview that motivated her to take on a big family alongside her career puts her on the opposite side of an almost unbridgeable divide from most college-educated women. She doesn't believe in using artificial birth control and suggests that abortion devalues human life. She thinks old age programs, such as Social Security, should either be abolished or that women who have more children should get bigger payouts. She also thinks that universal paid family leave would be counterproductive. Working while raising a young child makes motherhood less pleasant, not more, she writes. It's emotionally tough to hand your baby to a babysitter or daycare worker, she argues, and it's draining to juggle calendars for older kids. Encouraging mothers to stay in the workforce with paid leave may make them less likely to have lots of kids. Few people arduously holding down a demanding job at the same time as parenting a young child will want to do that more than once or twice, she writes. When it comes to family, Pakaluk thinks that young women spend too long on the slogging path from kindergarten through college and graduate school, trying to establish themselves professionally during their best baby-making years. It's the story of growing up female in America that's like you can be and do anything, says one mother of six, who decided to become a stay-at-home mom after completing her medical residency. When you've accomplished all of the goals that are time-sensitive, then you can do these other things, like starting a family. Some of the women who pursue professional achievement end up trying to get pregnant in their late 30s and 40s, however, and may not be able to do so without medical assistance. At that point in their lives, the transition to parenthood can also be a jarring adjustment, this mother points out. One day they're in control of their successful careers, and the next they're facing a totally new way of being. There are some things just best done young, the mother says. Sometimes having kids is one of those. Pakaluk seems to wish she could sit down with all the ambitious young women at top colleges and dissuade them from what she and her subjects see as a devastating lie. That it's worth it to delay having kids, or to have fewer kids, or to not have kids at all in order to pursue personal happiness and professional success. Women, she suggests, should take their future family lives as seriously as they take their careers, and they shouldn't put off the former for the sake of the latter. For a career economist, it's surprising that her solution to America's falling birth rates is not a matter of policy, but culture. The fact that she is such an exception in the community she wishes to change shows how difficult that cultural shift may be. Next, from the under review section of the September 18, 2024 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, what Charlotte Shane learned from sex work. In the memoir, An Honest Woman, Shane uses her experience selling sex as the basis for a sustained meditation on male-female relations by Lily Owen Rowlands. Charlotte Shane was 21 and a graduate student when she started selling private sex shows on a website called Flirt for Free in the early 2000s. I was a disaster on screen, green, graceless, with a body too long and too soft, Shane writes in An Honest Woman, in which she chronicles the nearly two decades she spent as a sex worker. But the fact that she might be bad at camming was also partly the point. It was a wager with herself, a way of figuring out once and for all whether she really was desirable. Her teenage years were defined by an intense erotic longing, foiled by the sense that she was unattractive to boys. I reasoned that if I were accepted into environments where women were expected to be sexy, there must be a seed of sexiness somewhere in me. Shane's takings would be irrefutable proof of her worth. The money came quickly, $42,000 in her first year and thousands more in her second. But the rate at which it flowed exposed more about the breadth of male desire than it did about Shane's market value. Although clients might sometimes be compelled by obvious embellishments of orthodox femininity, blonde hair or implants, they could be just as enthusiastic about bodies that didn't conform to this rubric. The attention and adoration was far more sincere than it was lascivious or disturbing, as sex buyers are often made out to be. After Shane began offering her clients erotic massage and then full-service work, meaning all-out penetrative and oral sex, her earnings and her esteem increased. She regularly came away from clients elated by her own accomplishment. It didn't just feel like being good at a job. I felt like being good at being a woman. Shane knows that her descriptions of sex work might be used as proof of the job's perceived harms. The way it is said to subordinate women to their sexuality or commodify what should only ever be given for free. But she has little interest in sharpening the facts of her life to form a straightforward defense. Instead, Shane uses her experience as the basis for a sustained meditation on the misunderstandings that shadow male-female relations, whether paid for or not. Passages flit between her girlhood and significant events in her professional past. She recounts listening to her father loudly appraise the appearance of passing women, apparently oblivious of his capacity for hurt. And she writes about working a bachelor party where sex was a benign bonding agent and she felt welcomed into a zone of masculine joy and fellowship. Along with worldliness and financial security, what Shane gained from sex work was a familiarity with the male mind freed from the persistent sense that men are brutes, compelled by an uncontrollable will to ejaculate. Hers is a vantage on love and intimacy at once more dispassionate and more optimistic than the gloomy diagnosis of heterosexual relationships she inherited. Shane's writing has an exposing, unmediated style, the kind that's formed on the internet, where insight is reaped from the everyday. In 2008, she started a blog called Nightmare Brunette, in which she untangled the knot of her wanting to write honestly about sex work, but also wanting to have sex with men in a way that didn't feel like work. When the blog's readership grew too big, she launched an email newsletter, Prostitute Laundry, in which she set her experiences of home sex and work sex side by side, revealing how little distinguished them. Both could be damaging and degrading. Both could be arousing and meaningful. These blog entries and emails have since been anthologized as books, and to read them is to be reminded of the frank first-person essays by women which mushroomed on websites like Jezebel around the 2010s. But what makes Shane a more adept interpreter of gendered suffering and sexual autonomy than many of her contemporaries is her attunement to both the mechanics of the body and the ruses of the psyche. She catches glimpses of what is otherwise obscured, deferred, and distorted. And this gives her work a watchful and self-reliant quality that glides against the current of much millennial feminist thought. One target of an honest woman is the tendency among this cohort to treat straight experience as a foregone disaster. Certainly, evidence of bad male behavior accumulates in the book. There were clients who walled off sex from emotion, armoring themselves with ego and disinterest. This group gave credence to the common social depiction of men as perpetually horny demons who want to put their penises in anything. Shane also encountered the opposite, men who fused their vulnerability and tenderness to sex, for whom one could not be accessed without the other. And yet, she never slips into what the writer Asa Saracen calls heteropessimism, a mood that has flourished online, in which women are encouraged to loudly announce their disappointment with men, though rarely to the extent of resigning from heterosexuality altogether. Shane is also compelled by the numinous attraction that pulls her toward sexual partners and the unguarded tenderness that certain clients feel toward her. The task of her writing is to take these appetites seriously. She has recently spoken about men being her muses. There is much in the book about the socially mandated trouble between the sexes, ideas Shane assimilated as a teenager, like accidentally swallowing a piece of broken glass. boys and girls could be friends, but relations between men and women were either erotic or adversarial. From romance novels, The Monica Lewinsky Scandal, and Sex Ed Class, she got the impression that intercourse was especially dangerous for girls, always leading to some kind of disaster, blood, pregnancy, rape, mental breakdown, or an STD. Intimidation and harm seem foundational to definitional of straight sex itself, she writes. And yet, in the folds of her grandfather's porn magazines, Shane happened upon something that troubled this absolutist idea of female vulnerability. Blissful expressions on some of the women's faces suggested that they found pleasure in sex, or, at the very least, that they were effed, and effing didn't harm them. The models offered up a template of sexuality undiminished by the threat of punishment and shame that stalks women in particular. Sex, it turned out, could do something other than shore up the couple form. Not that Shane's work was particularly sexy. Although she writes with a real exuberance about clients with whom she shared a wordless chemistry and paid encounters that had the condensed intensity of a psychedelic trip, tedium is a prevailing feature. The job requires much mollifying, flattering, feigning interest, skills women instinctively acquire as designated emotional custodians of the species. Shane was particularly good at performing a certain blankness, the practiced dissociation of emptying herself out to be filled with whatever fantasy or need the client decants into her. There were the hobbyists who collected encounters with sex workers like rare vinyl, the fetishists who came with hyper-specific role-play requests too rarely indulged, and the romantics who wanted an attractive conversationalist to take to the Boston Symphony. This is the kind of high-paid work that gets called private escorting, or the girlfriend experience. But as Shane writes in an essay from 2015, she prefers prostitute, because what she sold was the promise of heterosexual penetrative sex, even if much of the job was spent clothed and engaged in conversation. Her point is to adopt an unapologetic and unashamed position for the job veneered in euphemisms for reasons of both legality and stigma. Even the term sex worker, which has tilted debates about paid sex toward workers' rights, can sometimes swallow its specificity, as if there really is something bad and wrong about charging money to engage directly with someone else's genitals. Men, Shane thinks, have an easier time respecting prostitutes than women who hate prostitutes care to admit. There were, of course, clients who pushed the boundaries of what was agreed on with her and whom she blacklisted with abandon. She can remember only one, though, whose disregard for her was so profound that he kept his eyes fixed on the TV as she filleted him. I might as well have been a Roomba gliding over his penis. To be treated like an object is also what made webcamming so grueling. Men regularly requested that Shane penetrate herself with a stripper heel, apparently oblivious of the idea that women have nerve endings and pain receptors and intimate vascular tissues that weren't hard to tear. In real life, the majority of her clients were courteous, even decent. Whether or not they're paying, people tend to want to at least feel like they're effing a sin-sake person and maybe even giving them pleasure, though Shane admits that simulating climax was perhaps the part of the job she resented most, since her orgasm mattered not because of how good it would feel to me, but because of how good it would feel to them. It is less the intensity of passion than the simple, almost infantile need for attention that keeps one regular client, a man she calls Roger, involved with Shane for 9 years. Their relationship also provides the book's organizing arc, which begins with an overnight session in a Marriott hotel and terminates with Roger's death from brain cancer in 2020. He is an atypical protagonist, the antithesis of what a John is imagined to be, a polite and unassuming middle-aged lawyer whose old-fashioned air of dignity and portly constitution reminded Shane of a patriarch in a Victorian novel. When they had sex, it followed the standard heterosexual sequence, meaning kissing, fondling, oral, vaginal. He was neither prone to jealousy nor especially demanding, except for a sustained need for psychic and emotional unburdening, and some assurance that Shane liked him back, or at least liked him more than his wife seemed to. When Roger professes his love and promises to stop seeing other sex workers in an act of make-believe monogamy, Shane is moved to study the shape of his infatuation. Through the keyhole of Roger's unhappy marriage and his infidelity, she fixes upon the bad scripts and the thicket of delusions that keep men and women in a state of ritualized misalliance. Bed death was the reason commonly given by clients to explain why they saw escorts. It was an excuse offered up with less resentment than regret at the slow evaporation of intimacy with their wives. When a client was physically grotesque or hapless at sex, Shane would feel suddenly twinned to his partner. If I could have outsourced or refused this onerous chore, I would have. But when a man was especially pleasant or sexually proficient, she felt disappointed by the wife's lack of interest. Throw the fish back if you're not going to eat it. Of course, what compels many couples to stay in sexless marriages is the familiarity. The comfort of a, "not tonight, honey," can be more bearable than the potential no of a new sexual prospect. Roger incarnated this repetition compulsion. Slowly, he and Shane stopped consummating sessions and stuck to spa weekends and Michelin-starred restaurants. Though taboo and risk-compressed paid sex into a unit served up like a line of cocaine, what Roger got from her was a second wife, more stylish or flashy, perhaps, than his real one, but with a celibacy that was markedly the same. There's a disaffected tone to much sex work writing that perhaps demonstrates some of the strict boundary management that keeps workers safe. The strip club where Mary Gateskill worked is described with stony efficiency as a place where women stomped across the stage and squatted to let men finger F them for tips. Sophia Giovannitti, in her own recent memoir, writes about licking the ass of a graying sugar daddy with all the impassivity of someone who has just mowed the lawn. An honest woman stands apart as a work blotted by grief, part memoir, part memorial. Shane and Roger shared the pool of cultural references and private jokes that build between real-life lovers or friends. The depth of his affection for her translated into a steady stream of regular income and financial advice, less transactional than symbiotic. Perverse, perhaps, to equate love and money like this, and yet Shane describes the bond between her and Roger as one of the most honest and equitable and respectful relationships I've had. Things change when Roger's brain starts to deteriorate and the overnight visits tail off. Shane frets about his surgery and fantasizes about his wife, who seemed shrewish and emasculating, startlingly absent from his bedside. How, Shane wonders, will she find out when Roger eventually dies? Periodically, she searches for him online until she comes across an obituary written without any mention of his ebullience or his humor, like the outline of a portrait yet to be colored in. That we rarely get a complete picture of our partners is also what Shane and Roger's wife shared, bonded by the provisional, tenuous nature of intimacy. Shane witnessed the version of Roger that wanted red wine and human touch. Roger's wife got the part of him that was lacquered with marital virtue and spousal duty. Integrating the disparate parts of the self that have been split off or disavowed is an interminable task, but one of Shane's hopes for Roger in his last days was that he might live more honestly alongside his desire. Sex work exposes with brute efficiency how difficult it is for both men and women to fully assume their sexuality. The social code punishes men who do not harden their desire into those brutish forms which can defend against the possibility of being humiliated or rejected. And it berates women for daring to satisfy their attraction to men. We're drilled to be vigilant against a man's presumed lack of integrity, so we can't trust, let alone enjoy our emotions of closeness, she writes in Prostitute Laundry. For Shane, prying out the splinters of masculine threat lodged inside her has been the work of a life. Since adolescence, wanting sex and closeness with men propelled her into loosely knit romantic relationships. Escorting satisfied some of her thirst, but the work was always a way to defy the laws and prescriptions that govern so much of monogamy. Marriage, she writes, always seemed best suited to those who wanted to lead the least challenging lives they could manage. But then Shane lobs her own marriage like a grenade into the end of the book. She met a man named Sam on Tinder, and the sudden compulsion to marry him surprised her. Coupledom can certainly look like a cure for the bad habits of sexuality, a means to straitjacket the more unruly elements of Eros. This is especially true if one is a sex worker, for whom retirement is always perceived as a kind of betterment. Shane worries, too, that commitment is synonymous with suffering and sacrifice, a trial you withstand through sheer fortitude. And so part of her motivation for tethering herself to Sam is to place another wager with herself, one as audacious in its way as her decision to start selling sex. If the work had been the way to determine whether she really was desirable, marriage would test the limits of her belief in the possibility of successful male-female interrelation. Call it an act of hetero-optimism. Next, from the Brave New World Department of the September 9th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine, How Machines Learn to Discover Drugs. The AI Revolution is Coming to a Pharmacy Near You, by Dhruv Kular. When I first became a doctor, I cared for an older man whom I'll call Ted. He was so sick with pneumonia that he was struggling to breathe. His primary care physician had prescribed one antibiotic after another, but his symptoms had only worsened. By the time I saw him in the hospital, he had a high fever and was coughing up blood. His lungs seemed to be infected with methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, a bacterium so hardy that few drugs can kill it. I placed an oxygen tube in his nostrils, and one of my colleagues inserted an IV into his arm. We decided to give him vancomycin, a last line of defense against otherwise untreatable infections. Ted recovered with astonishing speed. When I stopped by the next morning, he smiled and removed the oxygen tube, letting it dangle near his neck like a pendant. Then he pointed to the IV pole near his bed, where a clear liquid was dripping from a bag into his veins. "Where did that stuff come from?" Ted asked. "The pharmacy," I said. "No, I mean, where did it come from?" At the time, I could barely pronounce the names of medications, let alone hold forth on their provenance. "I'll have to get back to you," I told Ted. He was discharged before I could. But in the years that followed, I often thought about his question. Every day, I administer medicines whose origins are a mystery to me. I occasionally meet a patient for whom I have no effective treatment to offer. And Ted's inquiry seems to seem existential. Where do drugs come from, and how can we get more of them? On a wet morning in May, I walked to the stately gates of the Rockefeller University on the Upper East Side and met Sean Brady, a bearded and bespectacled chemical biologist who discovers medicines for a living. He had promised to take me prospecting for antibiotics. "Ready?" he asked, his glasses splattered with rain. Brady oversees a program called Drugs from Dirt, which sifts through soil samples from around the world in search of antibiotics. On our way into his lab, we passed a bench piled with bags of dirt, one from the Chihuahuan Desert, another from the Sonoran Desert. "My parents sent me those during the pandemic," Brady told me. He has been given soil from Saudi Arabia and the Serengeti. His collaborators have gathered samples in Mexican sinkholes and Australian grasslands. Inside the lab, we found shovels and black buckets amid flask and mass spectrometry machines. I took off my blazer and picked up a bucket, and Brady grabbed a shovel. We set off into the drizzle. Many of the world's leading drugs originated in the natural world. Ancient Egyptians soothed their wounds with aloe vera gel. Morphine and codeine came from the opium poppy. Ozempic was inspired by a peptide in lizard venom. Dirt is one of the richest sources of medicine because its microbes have been waging a war with one another for millions of years. Vancomycin, essentially a biochemical weapon that one bacterium uses to kill others, was discovered in soil samples from India and Indonesia in 1953. Around the same time, research reported that a bacterium in heavily manured New Jersey soil produced streptomycin, an antibiotic that became the first effective treatment for tuberculosis. The bacterium is now New Jersey's official state microbe. Different microbes thrive at different latitudes, and Brady once dreamed of collecting dirt from Alaska to Argentina. Lately, however, he has been content to stay on campus. "There's an endless number of local bacterial products we haven't studied yet," he told me. "There's plenty of good stuff right beneath our feet." He stomped the ground playfully. In 2012, a group of drug researchers warned that the number of new drugs approved in the U.S. per dollar invested in drug discovery was falling by half every 9 years, an 80-fold reduction in efficiency since 1950. They called their observation Irum's Law, an inversion of Moore's Law, which says that the number of transistors per computer chip doubles every 2 years or so, driving down the cost of computers. Many drug developers, the researchers wrote, had fallen victim to basic research brute force bias. They were powering through as many molecules as possible, more or less at random, on the off chance that something might work. The universe of potential drugs desperately needed a filing system. In 2017, John Stokes, a Canadian postdoc in microbiology, joined the lab of James J. Collins, an MIT professor of biological engineering. Stokes, who has long hair and glasses, giving him the look of a scientific David Foster Wallace, decorated his office with a poster of a skull and crossbones. "I think of myself as a professional poison discoverer," he told me. "I want to kill things that kill patients." Stokes soon ordered two sets of chemicals from a commercial vendor for $25,000 with the aim of scouring them for antibiotic potential. One contained 800 natural products. The other was made up of around 1,700 drugs that the FDA had already approved, but that might have additional uses. They arrived in a styrofoam box the size of a microwave packed in dry ice. Stokes was preparing to screen each compound manually, pitting them against microbes on glass plates, when he sat in on a meeting about biological applications of artificial intelligence. "I had no idea what was going on," Stokes recalled. "I was not an artificial intelligence guy." afterwards, Collins asked Stokes if he'd try a new and provocative approach, working with computer scientists to see if AI could help sort his compounds. "Let's just see what happens," Collins said. Stokes agreed warily. "I thought, this is going to be a complete S-word show," he told me. "For about 6 months, it was pretty much me trying to teach them what a gene was, and them trying to teach me what a neural network was. Neural networks, which are computer systems modeled on the brain, usually require vast amounts of information to learn. The most famous example, ChatGPT, digested the entire internet and still struggles with basic arithmetic. But the team planned to train its model on the relatively small data set that Stokes had amassed, 2,500 molecules. We had very low expectations of this working, he said. Why invest a bunch of energy? Over a couple of days, Stokes put each of the molecules into plates with E. coli and recorded whether they killed the bacteria. In a world without AI, he would have subjected the winners, 120 chemicals, or about 5%, to more tests, hoping that one might become a drug. But in this case, he had more ambitious goals. He and his colleagues fed the results into a neural network, along with each molecule's chemical structure. Then they asked their drug-finding model to search through a bigger data set for more hits. Stokes and Collins instructed their model to rank each molecule by its likelihood of inhibiting E. coli based on what it had learned from the compounds in Stokes' styrofoam box. Then they conducted real-world tests on the top 99. More than 50% stopped the bacteria from growing, a nearly unprecedented hit rate. One of the molecules, which was originally investigated as a diabetes medication, also seemed to differ in structure from any antibiotic on the market. Stokes tested it on other microbes, and it eradicated several of the most pathogenic bacteria on Earth, including a strain of a bacterium which is resistant to all existing antibiotics. Artificial intelligence had discovered a novel antibiotic that was promising enough to advance it into preclinical trials. Stokes and Collins had invented a new way to catalog the Broad Institute's million molecule library. One scientist called their breakthrough a paradigm shift in antibiotic discovery and indeed in drug discovery more generally. Antibiotics face a kind of Sisyphean challenge. The more they're used, the more bacteria become resistant to them, and so the more new drugs we need to develop. Yet pharmaceutical companies rarely invest in new antibiotics, in part because these drugs often make little money. Most antibiotics are taken only for a week or two at a time. Between 1962 and 2000, no new major classes of antibiotics came to market. There is a great distance between showing that a molecule can clear microbes from a little glass plate and proving that it can safely cure an infection in the body. Techies often get overexcited about what it means when AI can identify a molecule. Peter Lee, the head of Microsoft Research and co-author of a book about AI and medicine, told me, "Is the molecule potent, or do you need impractically high doses to see an effect? Is it selective, or does it attach to off-target cells and inflict collateral damage? Is it stable, or does it degrade in the body? Is it soluble, or will it clump up in your bloodstream?" Sometimes medicinal chemists can tinker with a molecule to improve its performance. Often they cannot. The techies are just waking up to the sheer magnificent complexity of human biology, Lee said. Lee is impressed by how much AI has improved drug screening efforts, and he's convinced that it will accelerate the scouting phase of drug discovery. Last year, scientists at Carnegie Mellon asked a large language model called CoScientist to make some compounds. It was able to search the internet for chemical reactions, select experimental protocols, read the instruction manuals of laboratory robots, and program them to mix the right chemicals in the right order. One day, scientists might develop accurate AI models of the human body, enabling a prospective drug to be tested on a model long before it's given to people. For the foreseeable future, however, prospects will need to keep playing minor league games. There is no AI replacement for expensive and painstaking clinical trials in which many medicines fail. Recently, a research team studied the fate of several dozen molecules that were discovered by AI between 2015 and 2023. The molecules performed unusually well in phase 1 trials when a drug is tested for safety in a small number of healthy people, but in phase 2 trials, which measure the effectiveness of the drug, they failed at roughly the same rate as other candidates. You always have to cross your fingers the first time you put a drug in people, Derek Lowe, a pharmaceutical researcher and a blogger for Science magazine, told me. All kinds of crazy stuff can happen. Lowe said that AI could prove transformational for drug researchers. I'd also bet that we're going to have some whopping failures, he added. We can't just turn it loose on any problem in medicine. AlphaFold, an AI system developed by Google DeepMind, learned to predict the structures of proteins from an enormous catalog called the Protein Data Bank, which took 50 years to assemble. Before I left Collins' lab at MIT, Andreas Lutens, a Belgian-Swedish computational biologist, beckoned me to his computer. Lutens told me that the lab has focused more on the effect of a molecule than on the question of how it brings about that effect. He was trying the opposite tack, locating a precise target and then discovering or designing a molecule to interfere with it. His aim is currently fixed on beta-lactamase, an enzyme produced by some bacteria which effectively chops up and disables penicillin, a classic example of drug resistance. If AI helps scientists attack a target like this, drugs that have lost their potency against bacteria could be resurrected. On a screen, Lutens pulled up an image of a tangle of purple ribbons, which reminded me of an explosion of confetti streamers. They represented beta-lactamase. Here's the binding site, Lutens said, pointing to an area in the center where a weapon could strike. He clicked his mouth and a small green rod with a few angular branches and a hexagon at one end appeared inside it. That's one of the candidate molecules, he explained. By occupying the binding site, it basically shuts down the ability to degrade specific antibiotics. Lutens had surveyed 18 million molecules to find the 1,000 that would best fit in the binding site. He would use these real molecules to train generative AI models, which could imagine new and better molecules to target beta-lactamase. Lutens clicked again, and the angular green structure changed into a straighter one with two hexagonal rings, another candidate. Then came a boxy configuration with a few spikes. He kept clicking as though he were swiping through Tinder for a match. 1,000 is still too many to make and test, he said. I'm aiming for 50 or 100. So now you use an algorithm to shortlist the best of the best? I asked. Actually, from here, we use human intuition, Lutens said. I'm looking for the most promising fit based on what I've seen and what I know. I watched him inspect molecules in a kind of trance. Then he turned to me. There's still a role for us humans, he said, smiling. For now, anyway. And now, a poem from the September 23rd, 2024 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I Nearly Died from the Socratic Method, by Diane Seuss. I nearly died from the Socratic method of dying, from hemlock unbeknownst to me, in my garden. Unbeknownst, I picked a pretty hemlock bouquet, mistaking it for wild carrot, inhaling enough of its noxious powders to drop a donkey, but not a god, and not a philosopher who must drink it as a potion from a cup. A poet? Who knows? Who can claim to be a poet? My Socrates told me to never make that claim. It paints you as a hot dog, a pea brain. Nonetheless, I sickened from the bouquet. My legs heavy, my lungs flimsy and sad. On the third day I rose and returned to the garden where I snipped a rose. Unbeknownst, a thorn snagged me, and another, and another. One more poem from the September 23rd, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, For Better or Worse, by Megan Fernandez. If New York has taught me anything, it's indifference. I have an eternal feeling and forget it in a week. Nothing lasts. I walk MM overcome by oranges piled high in a cart, by kids playing street ball in Tompkins while the small park dogs cheer, getting caught up in a stranger with a crow tattoo or a butcher unloading rosy carcasses on 9th Street. We all roll on, each with our little tragedies, our shrunken attention. At Lucian, I order half a dream chicken. I mean, really, the severed bird of my dreams. And accidentally dip my black hair in the triangle of my neighbor's martini glass. I smell like vermouth for the evening. And the next day bargain for 50 samosas at the deli. Stack them in my freezer until it looks like my childhood. And there are paintings, yellow and otherwise, and a carton of chucked cigarettes, Vogues, squashed by a foot on the street. Indifference is not the absence of care. It's the enlargement of so much life that it dulls heart song, even sweet you. My interiority has nothing on this city. You and I? We're nothing here. I answer a text with my voice. You barely make out my laugh for a siren, a couple decoupling, a fire burning a church into its ruin. I do a line and look upon the gold lights and dark rivers while someone swims in a bathtub on the floor above. Day comes, I carry on. Irrelevant. I am carried on. Well, we've run out of time for today's issue of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.